You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchen. It's Thursday, November 20th. A low-barrier shelter in downtown Astoria is pushing back at how Clatsop County distributed state money meant to fund beds for unhoused people. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
Lifeboat operates the lowest barrier shelter in Clatsop County. Guests can't use drugs or alcohol while staying at the 22-bed shelter, but Lifeboat does not require them to commit to sobriety and does not require referrals from another agency in order to get a bed. The shelter is, more or less, first come, first served.
We are the only shelter in the county where a person can walk in off the street directly into a bed.
That's Ozark Orak, who along with Aaron Carlson runs Lifeboat Services. The shelter they offer is a type of shelter that other providers have said is very much needed and in short supply. In October, Clatsop County leaders finalized agreements with a handful of partners who provide shelter beds in the county. The agreements distributed $1.8 million from the state, meant to fund a county-wide shelter system. Compared to what the county received in the prior biennium, this was an overall 6% decrease. But Orak and Carlson said that under those agreements, Lifeboat is being asked to shoulder a larger decrease than other partners who also provide shelter to unhoused people in the county and who are also set to receive a cut of the state money. Now they say they will need to look at reducing other services at Lifeboat. Orak told commissioners,
I invite each of you down to Lifeboat Services shelter so you can help us decide what staff to lay off, which services to cut, which meals to eliminate, because this is the position that we are in due to the county's funding decision.
Orak and Carlson say they had no formal conversations with the county before being presented with a funding agreement to sign this fall. Orak said that when they pushed back and said they would have to reduce services, the county threatened to take away the funding altogether. Orak and Carlson said they signed the agreement in order to maintain what services they could. The county stands by the funding formula they developed to distribute the state money. Under that formula, Lifeboat will receive just over $450,000. In the previous biennium, Lifeboat received $625,000. In emailed statements in response to questions from KMUN, Assistant County Manager Monica Steele wrote that under the contract the county has with the state, the county has an obligation to ensure no net loss of beds. According to Steele, under the formula the county developed, if Lifeboat dropped the number of days the shelter could operate, the county would need to allocate less to them and give those funds to another provider who could make up the difference in what beds are available. KMUN reached out to Oregon Housing and Community Services, which oversees the shelter funding for the state. A spokesperson said Lifeboat had reached out about concerns with Clatsop County's allocation approach, but said the state had not yet received and reviewed the funding allocation methodology. The state does not intervene in funding decisions unless the grantee, in this case Clatsop County, is not complying with program guidelines, intent, or grant requirements. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting. Workforce development groups, community partners, and the state have activated a rapid response system to support workers affected by the sudden closure of Rogue Brewery last week. The company closed pubs and shut down operations in Newport, Astoria, Salem, and Portland last Friday morning. According to the state, around 60 employees have been impacted. Rogue has confirmed that all affected employees will receive wages and benefits owed them. Tomorrow, there will be a rapid response information session to help workers navigate the transition. Topics covered include how to apply for unemployment insurance, services provided by WorkSource Oregon, job search tools, workshops and workforce programs, the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, food assistance programs, and other community resources and information. The information session will be held tomorrow from 1 to 3 p.m. Workers can attend in person at their local WorkSource Oregon Center. These centers are located in Newport and Seaside. or they can attend virtually by going to tinyurl.com/rogue-rris-virtual. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/rogue-rris. For questions or help, contact Katrina Sturgeon at 541-921-4420. That's Katrina Sturgeon at 541-921-4420. This information will also be posted at kmun.org/news.
A young humpback whale that was euthanized on Monday has been removed from the Oregon beach where it died. Scientists, veterinary students, and members of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians worked together to disassemble the whale on Tuesday. Tribal members performed ceremonies for the whale and collected some of its remains for cultural use. Scientists will examine samples to better understand why the 2-year-old animal beached itself north of Yahats. They say it was tangled in fishing gear, which is a persistent threat to whales and dolphins around the globe. NOAA fisheries officials say the gear was left over from the 2023-2024 commercial Dungeness crab season. The former director of the Oregon Coast Military Museum in Florence, Oregon, has been sentenced to 5 years probation for the sexual abuse of a 15-year-old girl. Jeffrey Cannon was indicted on 4 counts of sexual abuse, but he agreed to plead guilty to just one of them. In exchange, Cannon will register as a sex offender and avoid contact with minors, among other conditions. According to the victim's mother, the abuse occurred at the museum. The victim's mother told the Eugene Register Guard Tuesday that the lack of prison time was unreasonable. She said the sentencing, quote, felt like a slap in the face. The Oregon Department of Education is trying to handle a growing backlog of cases involving discrimination issues and violations of state education laws at schools around the state. And that means many students and families are being forced to wait months for cases to be resolved. In 2019, the State Education Department created a new reporting portal on the agency's website in an effort to streamline reporting of discrimination, retaliation, or other violations. The response from students and families was overwhelming in the years that followed. Submissions to the Complaint and Appeals Resolution Unit grew by 270% in just 5 years. The unit is currently reviewing 66 open cases, and resolutions in more than half are overdue. The Oregon Department of Education says that staffing is the major barrier to speedy investigations and resolutions. Last year, the Oregon legislature approved funding for 14 new Complaint and Appeals Resolution Unit employees, but reporting from the Oregonian earlier this month found that those positions have gone unfilled for more than 18 months. The Department of Education now says it expects those positions to be filled by the end of the year, with at least 3 more investigator positions to be filled before February. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Oregon lawmakers are in Salem this week to consider possible cuts to the state's 2-year budget. But as Dirk Vanderhart reports, they got some good news yesterday.
3 months ago, state economists told lawmakers they expect a roughly $375 million hole in Oregon's budget. Nearly all of that was because of big changes contained in the massive tax cut and spending bill congressional Republicans passed in July. The latest forecast contains better news. A surge in business taxes and improving economic prospects have reduced the budget hole to around $65 million. The forecast comes as lawmakers meet in Salem with many discussions centered on possible budget cuts. State agencies have been directed to identify cuts of up to 5%. The revenue forecast means some of those might be off the table, but Oregon isn't out of the woods. A month-long legislative session set for February will ultimately decide how lawmakers close the budget gap. I'm Dirk Vanderhart, reporting.
4 companies on the Columbia River will be compensated a combined $140 million as part of the project to replace the interstate bridge between Oregon and Washington. OPB's Eric Newman has this report.
The payments are an agreement between the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program and four industrial marine contractors, fabricators, and shipyards upriver of the I-5 bridge. Frank Green is the Assistant Program Administrator for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program. He says the agreements have been part of the plan to compensate businesses that will be impacted by new bridge clearance that's 116 feet high.
So these agreements are really, like I said, intended to focus on businesses that use the river and are trying to ensure that those jobs stay here locally, that they're still able to be viable, and that we're really ensuring that with the fixed bridge, they can stay in business.
Finalizing the agreements is one of the last steps before getting approval from the U.S. Coast Guard on a bridge design. The payments are contingent on a fixed span bridge being built. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
The VA is making it harder for male veterans with breast cancer to get care and disability benefits. The agency says the Biden administration falsely classified men's breasts as reproductive organs. But cancer patients say they're caught in the political debate over gender ideology. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
Breast cancer, regardless of gender, was among several illnesses the VA had considered presumptive under the PACT Act of 2022. That meant veterans who got sick after exposure to burn pit smoke or other toxins had a much easier time getting their VA claims approved. The Trump administration's policy change, which was first reported by ProPublica, went into effect September 30th. It requires men with breast cancer to not only document that they were exposed to toxins, but also to prove that those toxins caused the disease. The change applies only to men, not women.
And that's a real head-scratcher.
Terry Ballinger, a veteran of the first Gulf War, was diagnosed with breast cancer last year.
Everybody in oncology is highly confident that male breast cancer and female breast cancer are virtually identical. They're identical in the way that they're diagnosed and the way that they're treated.
Ballinger filed his disability claim when male breast cancer was still considered presumptive. Even so, he needed a lawyer to get the VA to approve it. Ballinger says he was exposed to a wide range of toxins in the Army, including asbestos, depleted uranium, burn pit smoke, and the choking clouds from burning oil wells. With no family history or known genetic predisposition to breast cancer, he says his service-related exposures are the most obvious culprit.
I don't want to say it has to be, but if you start eliminating possibilities, you end up coming back to that.
In a written statement, the VA notes the PACT Act presumes service connection for cancers of the reproductive system, but says the Biden administration falsely classified male breasts as reproductive organs. Critics, including several Democratic members of Congress, say the change stems from President Trump's executive order that bans gender ideology in the federal government. That order says policies must treat men and women as biologically different. The members of Congress say the VA policy change distorts science for politics. Dr. Ben Park is a leading breast cancer researcher.
The vast majority of male breast cancer biologically is, in fact, reflective of the most common type of breast cancer in women.
And the tissues are similar, with one reason women have higher rates of breast cancer simply being they have more breast tissue. He said it's irrational to use semantics about gender to treat male and female breast cancer patients differently.
To not provide care for one group or another based upon their gender, to me, doesn't make sense. That would be like, let's not treat colon cancer in men, but we'll treat it in women.
Some studies suggest male breast cancer is more common among veterans than in those who haven't served. The VA says it diagnoses about 100 cases a year. Mike Partain is an activist who lobbied to make sure the PACT Act included people exposed to toxic water at Camp Lejeune. He was born on the base while his father was a Marine, and Partain later developed breast cancer. He calls the policy change disturbing.
Science is science, and to interject politics, and especially what I call the gender wars that go on between the left and the right, it's an absurdity, and it's a slap in the face to our veteran community.
He also said it adds to what he regards as a serious flaw in the law.
The PACT Act covers the veterans who were exposed to toxic chemicals overseas. It does not apply to the Camp Lejeune veterans or military veterans exposed here in the U.S., which is a major pitfall of the PACT Act.
In its statement, the VA said it will continue to provide care and benefits for male breast cancer patients who already receive them, as well as for new claimants who can prove a service connection. The Democratic members of Congress are asking the VA to reverse the new policy and be more transparent about benefits changes. I'm Jay Price reporting.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. You're listening to KMUN.
As many listeners know, the program that you just listened to, the local and regional news on KMUN, is a fairly recent development. This summer, the Trump administration passed a rescission bill that clawed back a whole bunch of money from public media and community radio stations like KMUN. We had to make some decisions based on finances, and the big decision that we made was to cut NPR programming from our roster. This saved us a significant amount of money and opened up a lot of space in our programming, particularly in the news side of our programming. We also dropped down from 5 days a week of local and regional news to 4 days a week. This was an effort to make the whole process more manageable because with the change, we are producing a lot more news. We're seeing also changes in our news partners, the local newspapers that we rely on for some of our local content. We're finding that they're just not providing as much for us as they have in the past. So all of that to say is a lot of time goes into the newscast these days. It took a lot of time in the past, and it takes even more time now as we are literally filling more time. But before all of these changes happened, we had put some time into our webpage. You can find it at kmun.org/news. We wanted this to be a spot where you could find links to some of the stories produced by our local news partners, stories that we severely condense so that they'll fit on the radio. We wanted to make sure that you could kind of at a glance see what's going on in the area. We also wanted a place to put my reporting, the stories that I'm working on. And for those stories, I'm not just sticking my radio script up on the website. I'm actually writing multiple versions of these stories, one for radio and one for you to read on the web. Now, a lot of the time that we were spending on that webpage had to go to the wayside while we focused all of our attention on the big changes happening on the airwaves. But I thought this might be a good time to remind you that that is a resource for listeners. And I've been posting a fair number of stories there recently. The other thing that that webpage provides is access to our news podcast. This is essentially the local and regional news that you hear beginning at 8:29 a.m. or 5:29 p.m. every day. We put that into a podcast form. It sounds a little bit different because we can't include all the music breaks, but essentially it's all the stories are the same. It's a way for listeners to access the news broadcast at any time of day. We typically post the podcast version of the newscast after the morning news has already aired on KMUN. To find the news podcast, just go to kmun.org/news, scroll all the way down, you'll find the last 10 days worth of news in podcast form. We hope you check it out. We hope you read some of the stories if that sparks your interest, and let us know what you think. You can email us at news1@kmun.org. Thanks as always for listening. Thank you everyone who has reached out with your feedback, with your support. Honestly, the response to all these changes has been really lovely. We've gotten some really constructive comments, and we just know that you support us, and we appreciate that. All right, that's all for me.